Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on liquefied natural gas lawfare, pause, permitting, and policy for American gas exports. Our moderator today is Daniel West. Dan is the director at SCF Partners, where he focuses on assessing new investment opportunities and providing strategic growth assistance for clients. Prior to joining SCF, Dan served as a captain in the United States Marine Corps. Our two panelists are Gabriel Collins and Spencer Churchill. Gabriel is the Baker Botts Fellow in Energy and Environmental Regulatory Affairs at Rice University's Baker Institute. He was previously an associate attorney at Baker Hostetler and is the co-founder of the China Signpost Analysis Portal. Spencer is an associate at Winston and Strawn, where he has experience as a former trial and appellate clerk, and uses this to litigate white-collar, commercial, administrative law, and constitutional matters. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Dan, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Caroline. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Our topic today is liquefied natural gas, or LNG. LNG technology has enabled the United States to become the world's largest exporter of natural gas in recent years, boosting our allies' energy security and our own economy here at home. Some estimates show that U.S. LNG export capacity will almost double over the next several years as facilities currently under construction come online. But LNG growth has been opposed by those concerned about its environmental impacts, including the Biden administration. The battle over LNG has now made its way into the courts, with lawfare ongoing on several fronts regarding this important energy infrastructure, as we'll discuss today with Gabe and with Spencer. So let's jump in, and let's start with you, Gabe. Can you give our generalist audience a brief overview on LNG? What is LNG exactly? How and why has it grown in recent years? And can you discuss its important role not only in energy markets, but also in geopolitics?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dan. It's wonderful to be here with you guys today. So what LNG fundamentally is you take the methane molecule, good old CH4, natural gas, and you chill it down to minus 261 degrees Fahrenheit. You basically end up with a liquid that occupies about 1/600th of the volume that a gas would. And so what this enables you to do, what's transformational about it, is previously natural gas was something where if I wanted to trade with any of you, we had to have a pipeline that actually linked us. And so it was a monopsony relationship. It's you and me connected. There's not a lot of options outside of that. What LNG has done is, even though it is logistically a bit more complicated to deal with than crude oil, for instance, because it is a cryogenic liquid, you still have the ability to put it on a ship. And once you get on tidewater, you can go anywhere on Earth that there's a regas terminal that you can hook up to that's able to take that liquefied methane off of your ship and turn it into actual, to regasify it and then feed it into a pipeline and use it on shore. And this is one of the ways it's been transformational on a number of levels. There's certainly on the environmental level, because a lot of the growth markets for LNG, if we think about places like Bangladesh, like Pakistan, like China, and so forth, these are places where, when you're thinking about baseload fossil resources, it's usually competing with coal and displacing coal. So you have about half the carbon emissions per unit of energy generated. So you get gains there. You also see huge geopolitical benefits. And we've really seen this in the context of Russia weaponizing natural gas before, in the run-up to its invasion of Ukraine in 2022, and then thereafter as the Nord Stream pipeline went offline and as countries sought to move away from Russian energy. We basically saw a situation where within a couple of months, this ability to move gas by sea, there was a wholesale shift from U.S. exporters, mostly sending cargoes to Asia, almost completely inverted that volume chart and sent it to Europe. And it basically helped the Europeans weather what otherwise would have been a pretty serious gas starvation as Russian pipeline supplies were compromised.
So despite all that, Gabe, it seems that not everyone's a fan of LNG, right? I mean, it enables markets to work better. It seems like there's some geopolitical benefits, but there's real opposition. So can you talk a bit about the environmental opposition and what motivates them? And in your view, is LNG unambiguously harmful to international efforts to meet climate goals, given the available alternatives for importing countries?
Certainly. So for someone who is a recovering lawyer, getting a straight answer on any, out of me on anything that has unambiguously as a qualifier might be difficult, but I'll certainly run through what I think are some of the main points of opposition and then what some of the ultimate intent may be but behind some of the legal activities and politics surrounding it that we see now. And so when you think about potential environmental ramifications, it's really there's one that is simply methane itself, if you do have leaks in a pipeline system, is proportionally a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is. Now, we've seen enormous progress all throughout the U.S. oil and gas industry, basically from the wellhead, at least to the city gate, in reducing methane emissions. Now, once you get into cities and their gas distribution systems, some of them are 100 or more years old, and you actually have pretty significant leakage problems. But all of kind of the industrial scale gas infrastructure, I think by and large, we actually do pretty good job here. So, you know, you can question that point of objection. The other point, I think fundamental point of objection, comes from the fact that LNG is still methane. It still contains carbon. It's CH4 is your chemical formula. And if we're thinking about energy sources, I think there is a certain segment of the body politic that anything that yields energy that contains the carbon atom, at some level, there's an original sin aspect to that. And I think that is held against LNG. It's really important to think about this in terms of what are you actually benchmarking against? Mm-hmm. Because if you're benchmarking LNG or gas use against nuclear, coal, wind, geothermal, those are not coal, we'll talk to in a second, all these sort of low or no carbon resources, then you can make it actually look quite bad. You say, look, if we burn a million tons of this, we get a significant amount of carbon emissions. If, however, you benchmark it against what it actually competes with in many cases, which is coal, you're actually basically cutting your emissions per unit of energy created by half. The other way to think about LNG as well, and this is really important in a U.S. context, when you think of the role gas plays, and I think it's important in a lot of the customer countries, is you ask, what is gas's purpose in a system, and what advantages does it have over coal other than being lower carbon emissions profile and emitting less particulates and things like that? And probably the biggest of those is gas plants can throttle up and down really rapidly. And so when you're thinking about intermittent renewables like wind and solar, the best way to think about gas is not as something that's in opposition to those. They're complementary goods. It's basically the relationship between a hamburger and the bun. One makes the other better. It helps you fill your intermittency gaps, and it does it in a way that's much more responsive than coal. It's more efficient, and you emit less CO2 in the process if you're concerned about that.
Okay, great. So maybe some environmental benefits, maybe some enabling of intermittent stochastic renewables, but also carbon emissions associated with it. And that's driving significant opposition. And that opposition, that battle over LNG, has made its way into the court system in recent months. So, Spencer, let's turn to you on that. So when the Biden administration announced a policy earlier this year that it would unilaterally pause, is the word that they used, pause new approvals of LNG exports, you co-authored a piece in the Federalist Society Review arguing that policy was not legal. And then just last month, the federal district judge issued a stay on the policy, ruling that the states challenging it were likely to succeed in arguing that the policy violated the Natural Gas Act and the Administrative Procedure Act. So congratulations on your prescience. But could you, for our audience, tell us what was the administration's policy, just some detail on that? And what are the best arguments for and against the legality of that policy?
Thanks, I appreciate it. Yes, you're right. This January, the White House indefinitely suspended the export-friendly operation of the Natural Gas Act. It said that the Department of Energy would not be authorizing any new LNG exports to non-free trade agreement nations until the department had time to revise some of its underlying analyses that informed its decisions. The announcement did make passing reference to the potential impact of LNG exports on domestic energy costs, but it did make clear that its primary focus was having the Department of Energy, or DOE, conduct new environmental studies. So I think from start to finish, you can see when it opened its announcement, it said the president's view is that climate change is the existential threat of our time and demanded urgent action to protect the future for generations to come. And the announcement ended by talking about the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to leading the way in ambitious climate action. And substantively, when it explained why DOE needs to conduct new analysis, it said that new studies needed to be conducted in light of an evolving understanding of the impacts of methane on our planet. The policy decision to suspend these export authorizations has faced a number of legal challenges, but I think we could group the primary issues into three main categories. There are challenges to the department's authority to consider global environmental impacts. And then there are challenges to the department's authority to delay export authorizations indefinitely while they study those impacts. And then finally, there are arguments that the policy marks an arbitrary and capricious departure for the department's past practices and findings. So starting with the first set of challenges, that arises under the Natural Gas Act, which gives DOE very limited authority to deny LNG export applications. Under Section 3C of the Act, DOE has to grant every application to export LNG to a country with which the U.S. has a free trade agreement. So really, DOE only has discretion in dealing with exports to non-free trade agreement nations. And even there, the Natural Gas Act establishes a presumption in favor of authorization. It requires DOE to grant export applications, quote, unless it finds that the proposed exportation will not be consistent with the public interest. So DOE has traditionally treated this public interest analysis as an economic question. They're focused on things like the domestic need for the gas that might be exported, whether the exports posed a threat to the security of domestic natural gas supplies, and whether there's anything about a particular export arrangement that might undermine DOE's policy of allowing free market competition. There's a lot that could be said on the point, but I'll briefly sketch out a few reasons why I think that's the correct interpretation and why the public interest assessment should not be understood to include an evaluation of broader global environmental impacts of LNG consumption. The first reason is the Natural Gas Act doesn't give DOE authority to make decisions that actually impact global LNG consumption. U.S. producers can export any volume of LNG to free trade agreement countries, and those countries can export LNG to other countries. So essentially, Congress has already made the decision to authorize LNG exports in any volume and to accept the economic benefits of exporting natural gas, regardless of any environmental effects. The authority that Congress gave DOE was only the narrow authority to limit where U.S. LNG exports go in the first instance. Can it go to a non-free trade agreement directly or not? And that decision doesn't implicate any public interest that there might be in mitigating global environmental impacts of LNG consumption. A second reason I think that the public interest analysis shouldn't include a sweeping environmental evaluation is DOE has previously determined through notice and comment rulemaking, interpreting its statutory authority, that at most it should consider environmental impacts starting from the point that LNG is delivered to an export vessel and extending until the vessel enters the territorial waters of the receiving country. The upstream, downstream, and cumulative environmental impacts of the use of LNG is removed from the export process under DOE's authority. And it's an issue that falls into the purview of other agencies or foreign sovereigns. Because DOE has limited authority, it determined that the environmental analysis it has to conduct under NEPA doesn't have to include any project-specific environmental analysis of export applications. Instead of project-specific analysis, it did a one-time analysis embodied in categorical exclusion B57, stating that the environmental impacts of export authorizations are not significant and don't require further NEPA review. In short, the first set of arguments, and I'll be quicker about the others, but the first set of arguments is it's arbitrary and capricious for DOE to hold export applications in suspense pending additional evaluation of environmental questions that don't actually bear on the limited set of export decisions that DOE has authority to make. The second set of challenges, I think, underscores the problem with holding export applications in suspense. It also arises from the Natural Gas Act, which requires DOE to authorize LNG exports, quote, upon application, unless after opportunity for hearing, it finds that the proposed exportation will not be consistent with the public interest. The statute also instructs DOE to ensure expeditious completion of all such proceedings. What we see under the new policy, of course, is DOE doesn't authorize LNG exports upon application. It doesn't hold a hearing expeditiously. It doesn't even claim to have evidence that would overcome the statutory presumption in favor of exportation. That's why they need to do new studies. And so in a situation where they've been told to authorize export applications upon application, unless they can make a expeditious public interest finding to the contrary, they don't have the evidence to support a finding that exportation is against the public interest, and yet they're not granting the authorization either. The third set of challenges revolves around the new policy's arbitrary departure from past decisions and practices at DOE. For example, DOE determined just last summer that there was no factual or legal basis to grant a request that they suspend approval of LNG export applications until they could do further studies. And they've, you know, done a complete reversal of that decision without any
6 months later, right?
Record explanation. Right, exactly. 6 months later. And you know, more broadly, the entire notion that DOE can consider global environmental impacts is a departure from its past interpretations of the Natural Gas Act and NEPA in the categorical exclusion I mentioned. I think you also asked about sort of what the best arguments are on the administration side. I think the best defense I can think of so far is probably pivot away from environmental issues. I think I mentioned the announcement of the new policy. It does include a reference to impacts that exports would have on domestic energy costs. And that fits more comfortably in the realm of economic analysis that DOE has more traditionally considered as part of the public interest analysis. So I think that might get the administration around the first set of challenges over whether the new studies are even relevant. But I think the administration would still need to reckon with the Natural Gas Act's instruction to complete proceedings expeditiously, and also just with the lack of explanation for why DOE is reversing its past positions.
Yeah. And to your point about domestic energy costs, right, it's true, isn't it, Gabe, that around the world, people pay as much as 10 times the price for natural gas that we pay here. And the arbitrage between that price spread is what incentivizes people to build these billion-dollar facilities. But if you didn't see those prices converge, you could see prices rising domestically. Is that a good way to frame that argument?
I think it's definitely a way you can frame it. One of the things that's also really important to consider is the role that is how exports interface with our domestic energy markets. And that is the simple reality that optionality generally facilitates healthier markets. And so having that export valve, and we've seen this in crude oil too, it's not just a natural gas thing. Having the ability to export and to directly interface with the global market, when you think about how that feeds back into infrastructure and investment decisions domestically, generally they're things that are pro-growth and pro-diversity and actually yield a healthier, more resilient market ecosystem that ultimately benefits consumers relative to what you would have had otherwise. And we've there's actually studies that, you know, we've done and that, you know, my colleague Ken Medlock has done in the not too long ago past here at the Baker Institute that affirm all that economic metrically. So, you know, there's empirical data that supports it.
Okay. So Spencer, so administration announces the pause in January, trial judge issues the injunction. Mm-hmm. Procedurally, where do we go from here? Where does the case sit? And does that ruling from the judge mean that the administration now has to approve all LNG permits or all LNG exports to the countries in question? Or is it more complicated than that?
I think it is a little more complicated than that. The pause is preliminarily enjoined. Litigation is sort of continuing for a final merits decision. But even sort of in terms of current status, I guess the key thing is while the administration is no longer allowed to pause authorization decisions, there's still at least two important questions in my mind. First, what is the timeline for DOE to hold hearings and issue decisions on its export applications? As we've discussed, the Natural Gas Access uses words like expeditious and upon application. It doesn't set any, you know, specific calendar schedule. And the court's order enjoining the pause in consideration of applications doesn't set a timeline either. So even though there can't officially be a pause, there may still be delays in processing applications, and individual applicants might find that for whatever reason, their applications continue to languish. I think after a certain point, they may need to push things forward with, they might consider, for example, APA claims to compel agency action unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed. The second issue is the fact that DOE can't suspend decisions anymore doesn't necessarily mean that its decisions have to be favorable. I think they likely would, given sort of the current state of studies. In the past, DOE's always approved export applications, and it hasn't completed the studies that the administration thought might move the needle. But my understanding is DOE's hoping to finish the new studies early next year. And depending on what administration is in power, then we might find that export authorizations become harder to obtain going forward.
Understood. So Gabe, so in his ruling, Judge Kane said that, quote, he had, quote, reviewed the voluminous studies attached as exhibits, all of which boast the economic and environmental benefits of exporting natural gas. And he also noted that the Natural Gas Act itself, quote, creates a rebuttable presumption that a proposed export of natural gas is in the public interest. So let's talk about the public interest. You know, when you look at the global energy mix and you expert, you study this every day. What are the pros and cons of natural gas and LNG in particular in the global energy mix? What is it? What is it from a freedom perspective, from a prosperity perspective, from an environmental perspective? How does natural gas fit in the energy mix globally?
I think probably the way to think about it that really encapsulates a lot of that is think about what the implications are of energy abundance for human well-being. And you think about how a given energy resource factors into that. And LNG factors in quite well because, you know, if you can look at a couple of different contexts. You may have a context where it's a country that's already industrialized and, you know, energy demand is maybe still growing, but not at the same rate. We're already very energy abundant. You know, a place like the US, like Western Europe, like most of the OECD countries, and what gas, the role it serves there, it's a primary source of heat. It can be a chemical feedstock. It's something that, as we discussed earlier, helps you integrate renewables and other intermittent resources into your system because you can balance and fill those gaps. And then the other role it serves is it's really a bridge fuel to whatever comes next, because I think we don't yet fully know what some of our future baseload power resources might be. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that hydrocarbons will be with us for a long time. But things like geothermal, like nuclear and so forth, there's real potential for scaling, but it hasn't happened yet. And when we need energy here and now to bridge us to whatever comes in the future, natural gas, I think, is as well placed as anything to play that role. That importance when you go to developing markets where they're still trying to address the basic energy abundance question, that importance is only amplified. And so for all these cases, the fact that you have a resource that's cleaner than coal, you know, it's one that we have a huge production position, and there's a fairly diverse array of gas producers around the world. And then it's something that, as we talked about earlier with what happened after Russia reinvaded Ukraine in 2022, you can shift really quickly in response to market developments because you're able to move it by ship as opposed to fixed pipeline. So whether somebody loves it or hates it, we don't use it because we like freezing liquids or because we like methane. It's something that the use has grown so much because of all the benefits that it offers.
Mm-hmm. And analyzed today in Western Europe, Central Europe, and maybe tomorrow in places like Japan and the Koreas, right? We'll want and need energy support that's flexible.
Yes, they're actually, I think the biggest disturbances you sense among our partners and friends and allies overseas from the pause decision and some of the lawfare and other things that we're discussing, you know, here on our panel today, have actually been our friends and partners in Asia. You see a little bit of concern from folks in Europe, but, you know, we've experienced firsthand, you know, conversations with folks from Japan in particular, folks from India. They're very worried about this because if you put yourself in the position of a net importer country that needs energy to feed its industry, to keep people heated and cooled, and to, you know, do all the other things that you do with the energy abundance that we have and that other places seek, if you were predicating your supply on coming from a place that you thought was large scale, dependable, rule of law, and so forth, and then things start to happen that call this into question, It really disbalances people. And I guess just as a to put a maybe even sharper point on that, and this kind of builds on Spencer's points from a moment ago, every month that resolution is pushed further in the future is another month that consumers in various parts of the world that might have preferred to use gas will instead have to turn to coal or some other type of resource to meet their energy needs. And I think on balance, even though I can't exactly quantify that, it's something that's probably not beneficial to any of us.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn then to another LNG lawsuit. Earlier this month, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals rescinded permits that have been previously granted for two LNG projects on the Texas Gulf Coast that have been authorized by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The plaintiffs in that lawsuit, who included the Sierra Club and a local tribal group, argued that FERC's analysis of the project's impact on climate change and environmental justice was deficient. One tribal chairman commented, quote, "We continue to resist ongoing colonization by the fossil fuel industry and against the Rio Grande LNG and Texas LNG projects. Fossil fuel companies habitually lie to regulators in order to get permits, to make their money, and to destroy the earth," end quote. So, Spencer, why did that party succeed in our courts? Can you talk about that ruling, both kind of legally, and also what's the practical impact of the ruling in that case, given that multi-billion dollar contracts have been signed, physical construction has been underway on these facilities for years?
Right, it's a good practical point. First, I'd like to be clear about what argument that succeeded. The court did not decide that fossil fuel companies are habitually lying to regulators, but it did accept the argument that FERC's analysis of the project's environmental impact was deficient. It was actually the FERC's second analysis conducted on remand from the D.C. Circuit, where it already had judicial guidance on deficiencies that needed to be corrected. In the D.C. Circuit, determined that even on the second go around, there were procedural deficiencies in the analysis. Not necessarily that the analysis was wrong, but that it should be redone because of mistakes that were made on the way. There are basically three reasons that the FERC analysis was vacated and remanded. So the first reason was the D.C. Circuit determined that FERC's environmental justice analysis was significantly expanded the second time around compared to the first time around, because the nature and scope of the information it considered was so different, a supplemental environmental impact statement was required that would have given the public an opportunity for notice and comment. But FERC didn't prepare that statement. It didn't provide the opportunity for public input. It, missing that procedural step, it was the first grounds for sending this back. The second reason was the DC Circuit determined that FERC failed to consider, for one of the projects, the developer's proposal to add a carbon capture and sequestration system when it was conducting its environmental review of the terminal. Even though the developer had proposed this system as technically a separate project, the two were connected enough that the DC Circuit determined they should have been evaluated together. And the failure to evaluate together was another issue the court wants to have corrected on remand. And the third issue is the DC Circuit determined it was arbitrary and capricious for FERC to exclude certain data from its air pollution analysis. The reasons FERC had given for not considering it were, in the court's mind, not supported by the record. And so either better reason has to be given or that information has to be included in the analysis. In terms of the practical impact of the decision, you're right. The multi-billion dollar construction contracts have already been signed. Expensive construction projects have already been started. The initial report is the projects which were started, or the phases that it started, are continuing, but that new phases of construction are being reevaluated. To Gabe's point, LNG exports support at least tens of thousands of jobs every year. They contribute billions to the economy. And even temporary delays to construction while FERC revises its analysis on remand could have significant impacts, both obviously for the contractors involved, but also to local economies. And that's why in the district court case that we discussed a few minutes back, that's why the court determined that several states had standing to challenge even a temporary pause on export authorizations. How these burdens are distributed, I think, will depend partly on the specific terms of the contracts at issue, including any provisions, sort of contingency clauses that hinge on project developers obtaining appropriate regulatory approvals. So I haven't seen the contracts for the projects involved in this case, but I do think that contingency clauses will likely be something that the industry pays closer attention to going forward. I think historically there was a time when FERC approvals were almost taken for granted, and FERC has lost three cases at the DC Circuit recently. It, I think, might be more exacting going forward. So I expect that contracts will be getting sort of extra attention in that context. The other thing to notice about the FERC cases is that they require the same type of environmental analysis that the White House's policy announced in January requires the Department of Energy to conduct. And that's something that Sierra Club, we've been seeing them pushing for in litigation for a while, is for both FERC and DOE to do a holistic analysis of environmental impacts, including impacts upstream and downstream from their spheres of regulatory authority. I think that's not only efficient, but also unfair, because it gives groups like Sierra Club the opportunity to present the same arguments to two agencies. And if they can't persuade FERC to stop a project, they can try and convince DOE on the same grounds. And there's not really even a process for sort of adjudicating disagreement among the agencies. It's just a two bites at the apple system where the most skeptical regulator always wins.
Mm. I think to Spencer's point also, when you think particularly about the downstream impacts, and you're almost creating a situation, maybe this isn't a perfect analogy, but if I were starting a local business here in Houston, and in order to obtain the permits to go forward, I have to essentially prove that there won't be global harms caused by it, or that they'll be below a certain level. And, there's an incredible burden shift that goes on there that, it really starts to raise questions of intent. Is it really about managing perceived risks and harms, or is it potentially about creating something that is so practically insurmountable that it's actually difficult, if not impossible, to get things permitted on a go forward basis?
Yeah. Thanks, Gabe. And that's a great segue into our next question, but I want to pause first to encourage the audience, our listeners, to prepare questions and be ready. So after this next question, we'll open it up to the audience and allow you to engage with our panelists. But Gabe, on your point, so taking a step back, right, permitting has become a lever for obstructionism across the spectrum of important energy infrastructure, right? Not only LNG terminals, but also pipelines, high voltage electric transmission lines, which would enable renewable power generation. It's really hard to build stuff in this country. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana recently said, quote, lawsuit after lawsuit can effectively tie up something and effectively kill a project. I'd like to say that folks on the other side of the dais want power lines and folks on this side want pipelines, but we really want both because we know that both are essential, end quote. So Gabe, can you talk about the deal with respect to permitting that first arose several years ago in the context of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which did not end up coming to fruition, as well as the bill proposed recently with Senator Barrasso to resurrect that effort, the permitting compromise? What are the prospects for permitting reform passing, and how important would that be for America's energy security?
So I'll answer the easiest part of that first, which is your second question, and the importance for energy security. It was simply put, it's tremendous. Now, in terms of the more complicated end of that, how do you actually get this to happen in practice? That's a really tough one because of all the issues that should be bipartisan, this one is right up at the top. And it's one where I guess where the maybe the rubber hits the road's not the best, you know, sort of where do you think of a river runs through it, you know, the wires or the pipeline runs through it. I guess that's really your key decision fulcrum here. Yes, citing the kinds of infrastructure we need is really difficult. And we're going to have to find a way to overcome this because you see a lot of discussion of decentralization, especially when we talk about aspects of the electricity grid. You know, that happens on a consumer level. I mean, yesterday morning, I ordered a standalone generator for my house because we're tired of being out for a week every time there's a storm. But at the end of the day, you can only decentralize so much when you're running a big, huge world-class industrial economy like ours. And you're still going to need long-distance power transmission. You're going to need pipelines. You're going to need ways to move molecules and electrons, in some cases over fairly significant distances, if you want an integrated economic system to actually function. And, you know, in terms of really getting that over the line, I'm not sure, you know, what it takes. You know, I don't want to make this a particularly partisan comment, but what I sense so far is if you look writ large within the Republican Party, you will see in some quarters significant opposition, at least on kind of a philosophical level, to some of the intermittent renewables. But at the end of the day, once investments go in, we see state and local officials being fairly supportive. And that suggests there, you know, on that side, there's probably real room for compromise. I think where the most challenging, and, you know, if you're assigning numbers, probably, you know, 15-ish% of the body politic is to deal with, is the hyper-progressive side where you have activist base, you know, in these wealthy bastions that already have their energy needs taken care of that don't want to see progress in interconnectivity in other areas. And, you know, as we've discussed here, they've recognized that lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit can stall a project sufficiently that financiers move in, lose interest, that somebody finds alternative sources, and you basically win by using friction to prevent something from happening. But the problem is, in that case, a private or small group's victory comes at the expense of the rest of society and their energy and economic well-being. And I don't have a concise answer to how we overcome that, but it's probably a decadal challenge, and it's certainly a huge one for the next presidential term, regardless of who wins in November.
Well put, Gabe, although we do have, I must mention, a number of regulatory lawyers on the call who are always happy to benefit from expense caused by friction in the legal system.
I don't want to throw my fellow members of the bar under the bus too much.
fair enough. Well, with that, let's open it up to the audience and see if we have any questions from the audience here.
Uh, Those can be viewed using the Q&A feature, Daniel, if you wanted to go through those, but I'm also happy to go through them.
Got it. I see here.
Got it.
So let's start with a question from Steve Bradbury. So he asks, what is the potential to move LNG by rail and what are the ramifications? During the Trump administration, DOT approved a rule to allow for rail shipments of LNG subject to strict conditions. Such rail movement could potentially address the lack of pipeline capacity for natural gas transmission into New England, for example. However, the Biden-Harris administration has rescinded that rule. So moving LNG into areas that don't have natural gas over land.
So I can see where the next lawsuit will come is when you go to site your regas terminal for your rail cars to pull into. I mean, in terms of this question, I love this question when I put my energy historian cap on, because you think about what went on, you know, basically from sort of 2008 timeframe until 2015 or so, is you saw this just massive boom in rail movement of crude oil around the United States and or into the United States also from Canada. That was driven by a combination of things. The first fundamental factor is the play to take off first in the shale boom was the Bakken up in North Dakota, and you just didn't have the pipeline connectivity. So you had to move things by rail because it took so long to build pipelines, even if you wanted them to be built. Canada was kind of the same thing. You couldn't expand the existing system at a rate that was commensurate with production growth. But in both of those cases, you already had all of your downstream offtake infrastructure in place, your refineries, no matter where they were in the country, and the storage terminals associated with them already up and running. And so once you cross the bridge of being able to move that oil by rail, everything else was already basically spring loaded and ready to go. Unless I'm missing something infrastructure wise, LNG is probably a lot more challenging because not only do you have to deal with some of the public perception issues and maybe some practical ones, if you have smaller volumes of this cryogenic liquid, you know, how do you keep it efficiently liquefied? You're going to have the reality of having to build some of the gas offtake infrastructure where your ultimate end user market is or somewhere nearby. And depending on where you are, I suspect that some of the same challenges we've been talking about throughout the call would probably crop up in various forms, you know, in terms of litigation and so forth there as well.
So question here from an anonymous attendee that I think is an interesting one. So this person says, some in Congress have referred to the public interest prong in the Natural Gas Act in legal tests as being, quote, globally communistic. So the public interest test, you know, does it refer to the public interest of the United States in that act, or is it the public interest of the world sort of understood more broadly? You know, is that being argued in the courts, Spencer, and how is that being treated at the state level?
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I'm not sure exactly what is meant by the phrase globally communistic. So I'm not exactly sure how to answer, but I do think the LNG cases present an interesting sort of example of how sweepingly broad understandings of the public interest can be problematic. It's, you know, broadly recognized, I think the Supreme Court has said, you know, the principal purpose of the Natural Gas Act was to assure, you know, plentiful supplies of natural gas. And that is the sort of default presumption that is established in the statute, is all of these exports have to be authorized unless, you know, there's a finding by DOE that the export would be contrary to the public interest. And so the delegation of authority to Congress, you know, under the non-delegation doctrine, it has to be controlled by, there has to be a limiting, intelligible principle that limits the discretion of the agency. And the question is, you know, how intelligible is public interest? It's the idea that you could say public interest is our intelligible principle, and it allows us to say, even though the goal of the act is plentiful supplies of LNG, to say we don't like LNG because of its environmental effects. We want to shut down, you know, all further exports. It does seem like now we're moving arguably sort of beyond the question Congress intended for DOE to be answering, especially when Congress doesn't even allow DOE to prevent exports to free trade agreement nations at all. It feels like we're sort of stretching the statute to a point where the intelligible principle almost turns things, I guess, on their head. And even without sort of considering worldwide global interests of other nations necessarily, the sort of the structure of analysis does, I think, raise interesting questions. So I don't know, we've obviously seen movement on Chevron, and maybe the next thing to keep an eye out for is what will be recognized as an intelligible principle, and can we get delegations under control?
That's a deep reaching comment, Spencer.
I was going to say, if you want, I can go ahead and sprinkle some chili powder on here with this one, because looking at this question and listening to Spencer's excellent response brought me back to one you asked a little while ago of, you know, how do we potentially bridge the bipartisan gap that we see so far on some of these issues? And I'll tie the two together in a second. So, you know, you think about this idea of, okay, what is the wisdom, if any, of making what's essentially a local or national or state level permitting condition subject to what's going on at a global level with so many factors that are beyond your control? I think something that flows from that is, think about some of the broader energy policy factors that are in the United States' control if we're wanting to shape a global energy environment in a certain direction. And the one that comes to mind here, and this is what brings me back to, you know, what might be a compromise negotiating point. I'm going to preface this by saying probably a lot of folks listening are going to get angry, but I think the last time I was on here with you, Dan, I was talking about putting a price on carbon. So, you know, hopefully the anger will be somewhat, you know, managed. And that is,
I'd like to hear all range of views here at the Federal Society.
Okay, good. I've already put this on record in Foreign Affairs, so it's not something I can hide or act like I wasn't a part of anymore. And that is basically one of the things you might actually try to approach the progressive wing of the Democrat Party with in exchange for some real movement on permitting infrastructure is actually starting to think about a federal price of some type on carbon. And seeing that what that will do very quickly, you would only want to bring this up if you're ready to deal with all the consequences that might flow from it. But assuming that you are, what it would flush out very quickly is if folks want to negotiate in good faith or not. If you bring something like that to the table and folks suddenly want to sit down and have a real discussion, that's actually a positive sign. If you bring something like that up and you still encounter the stall and obstructionism, then folks would be revealing themselves for a different kind of intent. And that's just, you know, we don't want any development, period. But you wouldn't really know until you put it on the table. But when I think about kind of this link between local and global, if we're talking about what really I think kind of is an overarching concern that permeates all this stuff we're talking about, just hyper distill it, you know, that may be one way to start trying to cut the Gordian infrastructure knot. And gas actually benefits in that world.
Oh. So another question from the audience, what about the use of solid oxide fuel cells to generate electricity? What role do we think that'll play in the global mix?
I have to admit total ignorance on that. I mean, can tell you if you're looking at things outside of oil and gas, I'm a big fan of small modular nuclear and some of the advanced geothermal technologies, but I don't know much about solid oxide fuel cells. So I don't know about you, Spencer, but
no.
Yeah, many emerging technologies in the energy space, a lot of research being done, but in terms of what's actually powering the world today, you know, as a percent of the total, a lot of the new technologies remain fairly small in a lot of scaling to do.
Yeah, it's like 80 or 82% fossil, I think, if we're looking at global total primary energy.
So another question from what, and this kind of gets back to the winners and losers question and the political compromise question, from what parts of the USA does most exported LNG come? which parts of the country are hurt or benefited by LNG exports, and to which countries is most of the exportable destined? And maybe Gabe, especially you could even take that upstream as to where does the gas come from before it gets liquefied, because it's going to be liquefied on the coast in almost all cases.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, it's great that the Texan sitting in Houston gets this question, but I'm totally happy to take it. So, you know, I'm being slightly facetious there. The reality is, when you think about who's being, you know, if we want to use the words hurt or benefited, it's actually intensely local. And the reason I say this is, you know, I'm sitting here in Texas, and I think, you know, if we have folks sitting in DC or somewhere else, it would be, you know, fairly understandable if somebody took the view that if you're in Texas, this is just completely unequivocally a massive benefit. But where you stand depends on where you sit. Like, I'll just give you a brief run here, kind of from wellhead to waterfront, you know, where the gas would head offshore on the tanker ship. So if you're thinking about the wellhead end, there's a few places in the U.S. that are huge feeders. The Permian Basin is huge. The associated gas that comes up alongside crude oil and liquids out there, I think, is something today that's on the order of 20 BCF a day, about a fifth of total U.S. gas production. The biggest single source of gas production is the Marcellus Shale in primarily Pennsylvania, but also West Virginia. That, I think, is something like a third of U.S. gas production. And if you are looking at, you know, some of the other plays that are big contributors, the Haynesville Shale in northern Louisiana would be another big one. So that the gas comes from a whole range of places, because our pipeline interconnectivity from the upstream side is very good all across the U.S., but it's really probably three or four plays that are kind of the core feeders. And so for those areas, oil, and I say this as somebody who grew up in Midland, Texas, and Artesia, New Mexico, right in the heart of the Permian, it's viewed pretty unequivocally as a good out there in terms of providing employment, economic opportunities, all these other things. The midstream link is a little more complicated. Even here in Texas, when you're trying to get those gas molecules from the producing field in West Texas or in South Texas, in the case of the Eagle Ford Shale, and you're moving to get it down to the Gulf of Mexico to the liquefaction terminals, when you're building pipeline in West or South Texas, the big question that landowners have is, how much are you going to pay me? And basically, once you meet that number, they're usually okay with the project. Where it gets a little more complex is in central Texas, where it's sometimes hard to find a price that somebody will let you cross. And so, you know, I apologize here. We've kids have given me a bit of a cold, but it's as you're sort of moving down there, you know, once you get down to the coast, again, it's going to be something where there's a range of views. If you're the folks working at the terminal, if you own the terminal, it's pretty unabashed economic good. If you're living near the terminal and you're not a direct economic beneficiary, the views can be a lot more negative. And I say this, there was a hearing in May by the Texas House of Representatives. They have a subcommittee that deals with LNG issues. And I was, you know, I went down to testify, and we were in Port Arthur, and you really saw this distinction on full display, because you had local folks from Port Arthur and also some people that came up from Freeport, Texas, where there's another big LNG export terminal, who didn't work at the facility, didn't reap direct economic benefits, but we're in line to deal with some of the externalities that come from living near large scale energy infrastructure. And I think the mild way to put it is, they were not fans. And so, you know, it's something that it's really, you know, it's going to depend on what your relationship is with those facilities. But I guess the way I would kind of tie all that together, and this is, you know, something where I say it in full sensitivity to the concerns of the folks that live near the facilities, is I think ultimately when you're undertaking a balancing exercise, is you do have to take a view of, okay, what does society writ large do best from, and what approach is that? And, you know, sort of approach it with that kind of, you know, agnostic, utility oriented mindset, and probably you don't get a perfect decision, but it probably yields something better than if you allow specific groups to potentially take projects hostage.
Spencer, any final words before we turn it back over to Caroline?
No, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thanks for your questions, Dan.
Yeah, thank you both for making time to be with us today. And thanks to the audience for dialing in.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.